On April 12, 2019, at the Bozeman Public Library, MSU Wanderlust presented a Friday forum on the topic of the role of active citizenship in thriving communities, focusing on citizen engagement in city and county government. Eva Patton introduced the panel consisting of former Bozeman Mayor Carson Taylor, Gallatin County Administrator Jim Doerr, Trust for Public Lands Project Manager Maddie Pope, and HRDC Executive Director Heather Grenier.
Today's program is one that was thought up a year ago with the League and with Wanderlust and talking about civic engagement to start with. And so this is called The Role of Active Citizenship in Thriving Communities. And so our agenda today is that first we're going to find out how the city works and how the county works. And we kind of think we know that, but when we had our committee meeting, it was surprising how much some of us didn't know. So we're going to count on Jim and Carson, who I'll introduce in a minute, to talk about just the nuts and bolts of local government. And then the real pitch today is citizen involvement and citizen advisory boards and how we are a community, thank goodness, and because that's what makes Bozeman and the area tick, is the fact that people are engaged and how much our governments count on the citizens and their input. And so that's the real thrust, and we'll be hearing from Maddie and Heather on that. But let me just give their short bios. So Jim Doerr was previously the town manager in Methyl, Maine, and he was hired as the Gallatin County Administrator in July of 2014. The County Administrator is responsible to the Gallatin County Commission for the operational effectiveness of county government departments. Carson Taylor was elected to the Bozeman City Commission in 2010 and served on the commission from 2010 to 2018. In 2014, he was elected Bozeman Mayor, serving as the Deputy Mayor from 2014 to 2016 and as Mayor from 2016 to 2018. Maddie Pope is the Project Manager for the Trust for Public Land, and the Trust helps the communities raise funds, conduct research and planning, acquire and protect land, and design and renovate parks, trails, and gardens. She leads the Story Mill Community Park Project. Heather Grenier has worked with HRDC since graduating from MSU in 2000. She became the Executive Director and CEO in 2016. HRDC is a community action agency focused on evaluating and responding to poverty in the Gallatin Valley. The Warming Center is one of the many HRDC programs serving Gallatin County. Carson's going to take the lead here, and then Jim is going to be talking. So, Carson, take it away.
One thing, a couple of caveats at the beginning. One is, as I was sort of working on this speech and trying to figure it out, I realized that I think that I'm still involved in city government. And so I talk about we, the city, do this, and we, the city, do that. So just ride with that. Trust me, I'm not an elected official anymore. I haven't been to a city commission meeting in over a year. I'm not going to comment on whether I enjoy that or not, but I'm going to sound like I'm on the city commission, even though I'm not. And so for the sake of getting through this, but also imparting some information to you, I've overly simplified things. Before we get to that anyway, let me start with what sort of got me thinking about this. Thriving communities, successful communities, have some form of representative government that involves engaged members of the community. Those members understand the issues. They give their input to help shape community choices, with the end result that the representatives, the elected body, makes the right decision for the community as a whole, so that most of the people in the community own the decisions that their elected officials have made. They've taken part in it, they have a piece of it, but there's some recognition that ultimately the elected officials are going to make those choices. And if you can have the right balance of public and civic engagement with a good representative government, And part of good representative government is listening and taking in information that you get from people and then putting that in to a decision that ultimately works to the common good. Essentially, we are an incorporated city in the state of Montana with a charter. And the existence of a charter gives us certain self-governing powers that aren't available to just normally incorporated cities, which are more regulated. We passed the charter in 2008. According to the charter, we're a strong city manager type government. That means that there are five commissioners, one of whom happens to be the mayor, but he or she is really a commissioner. And those five commissioners set policy, and they have one employee. That one employee is the city manager. And depending on the city manager and the commission, there's a cute little negotiation that goes on about how much access the commissioners can have to the rest of the employees. There have been in the past city managers that have said to commissioners, you can't talk to my employees, you just talk to me. It's a little cumbersome, it's not very effective, and it's certainly not the way the present commission and the present staff work. They have much closer relationships, and I frankly think it's better. But the city manager basically hears the policy and puts it into effect. Commissioners are elected for 4-year terms. They're staggered by 2 years. So in some years, two people, some years, three people are up for election. And with the new city charter, we started a new system wherein you run for mayor. If you run for mayor and you get elected, you're not the mayor for 2 more years. You're the deputy mayor, kind of mayor in training, and then you're the mayor for the last 2 years. The mayors have certain responsibilities for public exposure, you know, greeting people and groups that come to the city of Bozeman, and the mayors run the meetings, and there are a few other things the mayors get. But basically, the mayor is like a city commissioner. They vote. They technically can, and I think I did once in my career as mayor, make a motion. So they're really city commissioners from a policy perspective. Pertinent to today's discussion, the city has, I think it's over 30 citizen advisory boards, which run the gamut from the beautification committee to the planning board, recreation and parks, historic preservation, it goes on. But citizens sign up, volunteer for those boards, they get appointed to them, and the commission uses the information that are generated in the boards heavily in their decision-making process. Similarly, the charter provides neighborhood associations. There are now 14 neighborhood associations in the city of Bozeman, covering about a third of the population. I would love to see the entire population covered by neighborhood associations, because it's another way the input can be given to the commission. Finally, we have a lot of plans. The main plan is the strategic plan, which was passed a year ago. And then as we evolve and develop more plans related to certain portions of our community, they all connect back to the strategic plan. But at each step of the way, citizen involvement really makes a difference. We're presently doing a community plan, a downtown plan, and the commission just had in front of it a discussion of the NCOD, which is Neighborhood
Conservation
Overlay District. There you go. Thank you very much. Relevant to historic preservation. What does city government do? We're doing our city government 101 class. Basically, safety, infrastructure, planning, and then service. And I put recreation in there because we're a city that cares about recreation, and we do that a lot. All of these things are fairly basic city things, and almost no one says you shouldn't be doing that. I will say water, if you know Missoula at all, for years, Missoula had a private company that provided them with water. Bozeman doesn't. Bozeman does the provision of the water and the sewer. Keeps the streets that are under our jurisdiction working and functional, police and fire. And I threw in the Board of Health. It's a joint city-county board. But it really matters. It pays attention to the health systems in the county and what are going on so that we can remain as physically healthy as we possibly can. That's the basics. Nobody gets in the way of that. But then some cities, and our city certainly, has chosen to do more than that. And that's where the rubber meets the road, particularly around historic preservation. And if you think of some of the issues that have come up over the past 15 or 20 years, they all fall into these category of things, which I think has to do with quality of life, community character, where the city commission is actually at some level or another with citizen input, trying to create or maintain the kind of city we are, trying to maintain a community character that's consistent with the reason that most of us moved here in the first place. That involves several things, one of which is global warming. We pay attention to the city's carbon imprint. We have a group of people that meet to talk about it. We have an employee and a half that's dedicated to it. And the city's very conscious of what its contribution is to global warming so that it can be minimized. Affordable housing has to do clearly with what kind of community do we want to live in. Do we want people living in our community that are different socioeconomically? Absolutely. And so part of that means how do we provide the housing that all of us can live in. Historic preservation relates to the connections that we have to the past and to just the feel of our community as we walk around it. The cemetery I put up there for a specific reason. I got it, my first citizen advisory board was the cemetery board. I didn't know anything about cemeteries, but Mary Mantle-Hall talked me into being on the cemetery board. In fact, I realized when I got on the board, I didn't have a single relative that I'd ever known that was buried in the cemetery. They were all buried in the farm or whatever. We have chosen to run that, and it's a great cemetery. I'd be happy to be buried in it. Well, I don't want to get buried right away. But it costs. And I think the general number is about $500,000 a year goes out of the general fund into the cemetery. Nobody complains about that. Is it because they don't know? But they're not thinking that far ahead? I don't know, but I love to put it up there because when people complain about where's their money going, and part of the reason that it's that much right now is we're trying to build up a long-term fund so that when you close the cemetery, you actually have money to maintain it in the way that people that are buried there expected that it would be. But it is a loss every year. A welcoming city. We've gone out of our way to pass ordinances and resolutions telling people of the world, you are welcome here, regardless of your race, your national origin, your sexual orientation, your gender orientation, and I'm gonna get the words wrong, but for all purposes, we have done that. We've done it by mayoral proclamation. We celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day in October every year. And in my mind, that's gone a long way to making the community more diverse, and therefore, in my mind, a better community along the way. Okay, those are the choices that we make. And that's where the rubber meets the road as to how active the city is, how big a bureaucracy you want, because all of those choices need work behind them for them to be real. What the city doesn't do, we have nothing to do with the school district in the sense of we have no governing power. They're a separate taxable entity. District court done by somebody else. The city and the county are separate entities, and there's some overlap, and there's some joint projects which we do with it, which I've listed up there. That joint planning committee, is Chris Mell sits on that, he's in the back. Those are joint projects that the city and the county are doing together at this point, and I'm sure there are many more, but I just put it in there to let that see. And then where it gets interesting is anything that state law prevents us from doing. So even though we have self-governing powers, every now and then the state steps in and says, nah, you can't do that. And I don't know if you remember when we were going to do cameras at the red lights. The legislature, I don't think that was good policy necessarily, but I felt like we had a right to do it if we wanted to. State legislature passes a law saying you can't do that. The big ones that matter are the state uniform building code we have to comply with. And that means if we wanted to be stricter, we couldn't be. If we wanted to require all new houses to have low flush toilets in them, unless that's in the uniform building code, we can't do that. There are ways to get around it, but we're blocked from requiring it. Gun laws. If you followed Missoula at all, They took a step. The state law says you can designate where people can carry firearms in the city, and you can't do any more than that. Missoula passed a law which affects, I think, the sales of guns in their city, and they're in litigation about it. And we'll see how far the courts will let self-governing powers go. And then the big one that we hear all the time is taxes. We're stuck with the state system of taxes, and they will not let us, unless they change the laws, do anything as simple as a local option luxury tax that only tourists have to pay, however you want to word it. We can't do that, even if we wanted to. There is a law that allows resort cities under the population level of 5,500 to do that, but we're a little bit over 5,500. So now we get to funding and where it comes from. The tax bill that you get from the county has on it what are called ad valorem property taxes. That is a tax based on the value of your real property. And it's one of the main areas that the city gets money. The city also has levies that are generally passed by people. There was a police levy, a police safety levy quite a while ago. The last thing was a bond, not a levy. And SIDs, which are again paying out certain infrastructure. And then the city has assessments, which it's allowed to do, an arterial and collector assessment, a tree assessment, a street maintenance assessment. Those are all sent to you by the city. So right in November, you get the county bill and you get the city bill. And I think there's another assessment for wastewater or something. I can't remember how that works. But those are the main things. And most all of that money that you see on the board is tied to property ownership. And that's where the sales tax comes in, because people get, you're taxing my property and I can't afford it anymore. We need a few more legs on that stool, I think. However, about 50% of the city budget has to do with fees that are received. And the primary source of that is water and sewer. And you're getting paid as a city for the water that you provide to people. So we kind of count it as a city assessment or a fee, and some people call it a tax, but it's really not a tax, because the less water you use, the less you have to pay. And it is a service from the city, and as I noted earlier, it's a service that we don't necessarily have to do. But when the city does its budget every year, and if the water rates are going to go up, that's seen as a increase in the tax. All of the services that are paid for here are meant to pay for their actual cost, right? So the water department doesn't make money that it can then shift somewhere else. It breaks even, and we do water rate studies to make sure that we're charging the right rate for all of these things. I'm not going to talk about impact fees and grants and tax increment finance districts. I will say one thing on the general fund. The city is not allowed to take the general fund up to a certain point. There's a maximum tax. The reality is that we never hit the maximum. We always come in lower than that. Now, there's some good reasons for that, but most of the other cities in the state have hit their maximum general fund tax, ad valorem tax. Okay. Budget features, just so you have a sense of it, it's around $100 million. There's no fact checking me on this. It's around 100 million. I think it was 118 this year. Close to the half of the revenue is fees for services. You think of water and sewer, you think of planning and building fees, but there also are, we have a recreation program and people pay for some of that. And my favorite, the cemetery. And I think this is a rough number, but the ad valorem property taxes are about 30 million of that 100 million. This is my tax bill, and then I added the city assessments to it for percentages. So the taxes that I'm paying, 38% of the total local taxes that I pay go to the school system, 25% to the city, and then you can read down 9% are city assessments. The county is about 8%, and public safety taxes are things like the 911 center. And there's also a Gallatin College levy that was passed as well. And that's how it breaks down. So from a tax perspective, I don't know why I'm deep into this, but people are complaining about taxes. And now that I'm not in office, I can just tell you, we do really well in light of what the limitations are at keeping your taxes down. And I don't think the city gets credit for paying that much attention to it, because there's a lot that has to go on in the city to keep it running. That is all I've got. So I'm going to go to County Government 101, and Mr. Doar will pick up from there.
Yeah, thank you very much, Justin. Thank you all for coming out and giving me an opportunity to speak about County Government 101. Carson probably gave me a really good segue into a point-counterpoint, I guess, if you will, between city government and county government. When Carson talked about self-governing powers, Gallatin County and most counties in Montana are general powers governments. There are a couple of exceptions. Butte, Silver Bow, Anaconda, Deer Lodge are separate kind of charter forms of government. Every 10 years, under state law, Gallatin County, counties in general in the state of Montana, put forth on a ballot the opportunity for us to vote as citizens on a government study commission. And that's our opportunity to change government. I don't think Gallatin County ever has. The last time was 2014. I was just coming into the job. I was actually a little nervous. Okay, am I going to get into a job that isn't going to exist here shortly? They didn't. So, what I put up here for you is the Gallatin County organizational chart. As you can see, there are an awful lot of elected officials in Gallatin County. We're generally governed by a board of county commissioners. They are responsible for the public health, safety, and welfare of the citizens of Gallatin County. But we independently elect the county attorney, the auditor, clerk and recorder, justice of the peace, we have two of them. Clerks of district court are also elected but are not county employees, they're state employees. We are responsible for all of their facilities. So the Law and Justice Center on 19th is county building, county funded, county maintained, but staffed by state employees. We elect a treasurer, a county superintendent, and a sheriff slash coroner. We put those together, those two offices. Those are actually two separate offices. Clerk and recorder is also the county surveyor. And the treasurer is the county assessor. So efficiency in government, we're combining. The things that state government says they cannot do. If you flip that on its head, I think you get a pretty good synopsis of county government. And that we can only do things that the legislature has expressly said that we can do. Fundamental difference there, I think, that can be sometimes hard to grasp. Impact fees is a good example. The city levies impact fees. The county cannot levy impact fees for development. The other one that I think is a really good example, and I like to bring up every once in a while, the city has an open container ordinance that they're able to waive for city music on Main. Counties do not have an open container ordinance. So if anyone's ever been to Pondskim at Big Sky, you'll see a really good example of how we do not have an open container ordinance. Again, general powers government, city operates under a council-manager form of government that Carson talked about. We have a board of county commissioners. They touch the other offices, sheriff, county attorney, everyone else, through their budget and through personnel policies. They cannot dictate to Marty Lambert how to run his office, how to discipline his employees. Those employees, deputy county attorneys, prosecutors, work for the county attorney. County commissioners have three employees by resolution. They have two executive assistants and then a county administrator. These are the departments that work for me. We're actually at the finish line for a deputy county administrator, which I'm really, really excited about. We just need to change my direct reports from 18 to about, I don't know what's up there, 8. I'm really excited about that. So you can see some of the things that county government does. Solid waste up at Logan is a county function. The Hebgen Solid Waste District up in West Yellowstone. I don't know if you guys know, we take all of the refuse out of Yellowstone National Park through West Yellowstone into Logan, what's not recycled. Operations and procurement, again, facilities. We have a compliance department. We do all planning because the theme of today is citizen boards. All of these people, although they answer to me, actually have boards that weigh in on any decisions that get made. So lots of opportunity to be involved in county government if you want to. I thought I would talk a little bit about just what impacts your taxes and county budget. Montana's tax regime, I guess if you will, when it comes to property taxes is unique in the nation. It's been four states, and Montana is one of the more interesting. I think particularly when it comes to how we fund government and how we tax people. We serve as the back office function, if you will, for a lot of the special districts, some of the school districts, Central Valley Fire District, for instance. They have a fire chief, they have a board of trustees. They don't work for us, but Gallatin County does approve their budgets. Yeah. It's a formality. county commissioners really have very little authority over it other than to approve it. We collect the taxes, and then they draw whatever money they need off of it. So if you add in all of those special districts, it's about $170 million. 30% we gather through non-tax revenue, fees, when you go to register your vehicle, solid waste, actually, well, that's an enterprise fund, paid for entirely out of tipping fees. Cash makes up about 45%. What we do is kind of buy down the budget so that we don't have to levy as many taxes. And a quarter of our budget comes from property taxes.
What does cash mean?
Cash is left over, basically. Gallatin County, all governments appropriate money. And all that means is it's the legal authority to spend. We do it in particular funds. So the general fund is the county administrator, treasurer, finance, those kinds of things. We say we need this amount of money to run our departments. County commissioners will approve that budget, deduct these things to get to taxes, what taxes are left. So the cash comes from predominantly money that is not spent at the end of the year.
It's 45%?
Yes. Now, let me throw my caveat in here, please. A lot of those are special districts, right? So that is not county government necessarily. That is fire districts. That encompasses all the districts. Countywide, solid waste districts, you know, things that you don't necessarily pay for out of your property taxes, even though somebody else might, somebody in a different district might. Does that make any sense?
No.
No? Okay.
Sorry.
Would these special districts levy their own property taxes that you are not counting as county property taxes?
With HOA fees? Or?
No, it's not HOA fees. No. So if you live in, I keep picking on Central Valley and I should pick another one. But I'm not going to. I'll pick. Yeah, Big Sky Fire District, for instance, will levy their own taxes. Sure. Gallatin County Commission ultimately approves those, but...
But you're not counting them in taxes on this chart.
I am. Yes. You do not pay for them. All of the money that Gallatin County collects is included in this, generally. And then it just kind of gets divvied out to different districts. So Carson talked about your Gallatin County tax bill. All of the money that comes in from all of the taxes collected from inside the city of Bozeman, not an individual, this is kind of how that gets divvied out. So 56% of it goes to school districts. Gallatin County keeps 15%. That includes the public safety segment percentage that Carson was talking about, and then 28% goes to the city of Bozeman. So if you're inside the city of Bozeman, this is kind of generally what your taxes would look like. This is everybody in the county. I mean, this is just, if you were to think about it as a single checking account, everything comes in and then it kind of goes out in these, to these different districts that may or may not, you might not even know it. You might not have anything to do with it. It might have absolutely nothing to do with you. I didn't clarify that at all, did I? All right. Well, maybe I can meet with some of you if you still have questions after this and try to explain that. But I'm going to move on.
Okay.
All right. So this is where Gallatin County spends its money by function. You know, public works includes things like solid waste, transportation. Public safety is the sheriff's office. General government I talked about. Public health, city county health board. And recreation are things like the fair, open lands. And then I just want to make a pitch for citizen service and citizen government. Gallatin County appoints people to 41 different boards. That's 233 individuals. There are actually more than that when you talk about the City County Health Board. When I talk 233 people, those are only the county appointments to that board. So there, you know, if you were to include all of those, there are far, far more.
So Jim, what's the process to get appointed to be one of those appointees?
There's a link on the website. You fill out an application, send it to the commission staff, and the commissioners will make the appointment. And actually, thank you. I actually have, so 230, they make 233 appointees. There are 16 vacancies, which I think really speaks very highly to the amount of people willing to be engaged in self-government. Ma'am?
Yeah, you said, and I double-checked because I might not have heard it right, that the commissioners cannot dictate to the other departments. But then you said they approve the budget. But it seems to me if you could approve the budget, then you actually do influence other departments.
Yes. Yes. Where the rubber meets the road, right? State law mandates that the county commissioners approve budgets. For instance, if they're really mad at the county attorney or the sheriff, they can't cut the budget way back. They have to approve enough money for them to operate on. So they can't use it as a really big stick, but they can certainly use it as a stick. So yes, they wield quite a bit of influence that way. Good, thank you.
You are tuned to KGVM Bozeman, Gallatin Valley Community Radio.
Hi, such a pleasure to be here today, and I'm going to talk about the Story Mill Community Park through the lens of civic engagement. Again, I'm Maddie Pope. I'm the project manager with the Trust for Public Land for the park project, and we are a nonprofit that works with communities to help develop parks. Our goal is that all people in cities live within a 10-minute walk of a park trail or open space, because studies show that if you do, that you will get out weekly, if not daily. So where the new Story Mill Community Park will be, in the northeast part of the city, just north of the interstate, it fronts Bridger Drive, and from there it goes all the way back to Story Mill Road and the Spur Trail. Our work on Story Mill Community Park is a partnership with the City of Bozeman. It will be a city park. We started this project in 2012, and I'm pleased to report that park construction is underway, and assuming it stops snowing, it will be completed in July and the park will open. We plan a public celebration on Saturday the 20th, so please mark your calendars for that. One of the reasons projects like this take a long time is because they require really well-constructed public-private partnerships to be successful and enduring. And in order to effectively engage people's ideas, you really have to take that time to let people participate and have an effective impact on the formation of the project. That is the foundation for everything that comes later to make a project like this successful. So, beginning in 2012, the voters in the city of Bozeman passed the first ever Parks and Trails bond, creating funding for us to do park development and upgrades. This referendum was passed by 74%, which is of resounding support. And to me, this citizen-led initiative was a direct response to the pace of growth that we're all experiencing. Voters realized that parks and trails are essential infrastructure. I would be so bold as to say, as valued and important as roads, schools, and other services, access to parks and trails helps to retain, I always say quality of life, but I like Carson's word, community character, in a really important way when cities are going through the kind of growth and change that we're going through. So with the passage of the bond in 2012, the city set up the Trails Open Space and Parks Advisory Committee. This was a citizen-led volunteer board appointed by the commission and led by our very own Bob Hawks, who I know is somewhere in the back of the room. So when the Story Mill Community Park Project went before the so-called TOP, Trails Open Space and Parks Board, in 2012, we were meeting on the second floor of the Stiff Planning Building in a reasonable-sized room, maybe a little smaller than this room, and it was packed with people who came to support the project. At one point, in fact, the fire chief, who was at a meeting across the hall, stormed into the room and said people had to leave because of overcrowding. The president of Trust for Public Land happened to be there with me today. He's from San Francisco, and he looked at me and smiled and said, "Gosh, being in Bozeman is like living in a Frank Capra movie." But to back up a bit, Trust for Public Land purchased the property in 2012 from American Bank. The bank had received it in foreclosure proceedings after a developer went bankrupt, and it's a 60-acre property. I may not have mentioned that. We were very transparent and put the project forward through an article in the Chronicle, basically saying that we were creating the opportunity to create this new park, but it would really require considerable community engagement and support if it were to move forward. The first survey that we put out into the world, about 700 participants, it was a volunteer sort of survey monkey survey, 700 participants took the survey, and then we held a workshop in February of 2013, and 175 people spent half a day with us to talk about their ideas for the project. And it was at that moment that I knew that people were going to really care about this project, and they were going to come out, and they were going to help us transform this property into a lasting park. Later, when we came before the commission with the top committee's recommendations to proceed, we worked with another citizen-led board, the Recreation and Parks Advisory Board. They advised the Parks Department, and they were a really important voice because they were able to give the perspective and bring the credibility of looking at all of the parks and trails for the city of Bozeman and talking about why this new park would be important and why it would fit in. And that Recreation and Parks Advisory Board has been a touchstone board for us for the last 8 years in almost every decision we've made. We're fortunate because we had the luxury of time to engage the community on this process. As we went forward with design and city review, focus groups that grew out of our workshops continue to advise our design team, providing guidance and feedback. And we spoke to as many community boards and groups as we could to get the word out. In fact, we were here in front of the Friday Forum in 2015, and that was a great group. A lot of people got involved as a result of that. Rotary clubs, neighborhood councils, nonprofit boards, on and on. So really, involvement in many different ways when it comes to projects like this is really important and helpful. We also organized some of our own volunteer committees. We brought riparian experts together to advise on a restoration that resulted in quite a large-scale restoration of the site's rivers and wetlands and floodplains. And that was a group of 8 people that met monthly for at least a year. Nonprofits from all over the community stepped up. Montana Conservation Corps youth crews were helping us with site cleanup. Sacagawea Audubon taught us about the birds and wildlife on the site. Gallatin Valley Land Trust advised on trails. Run Dog Run helped us think about dogs in the park, Trout Unlimited, fisheries. The Gallatin Valley Food Bank, a neighbor to the project, helped us think about a connection to local foods and the heritage of the site. Greater Gallatin Watershed Council started conducting stream and groundwater monitoring. And each of these partnerships really helped us to understand better what this park should look like. So by the time we were before commission for approvals, people from all across the community were familiar with the project and had been involved. And in fact, over 400 people voiced support at that point in time with the commission. Throughout the design process, as we move forward for another 2 to 3 years, we hosted community workshops in partnership with the City Parks Department. We continued to show people what we were up to and get their feedback. We had over 250 kids at summer camps at the site. MSU started using it for soils and engineering classes as a sort of outdoor living classroom. Another board that was very important because there's a lot of history at this site was the City's Historic Preservation Advisory Board. They stepped us through the process of removing some old buildings, but also talking about how to best interpret and memorialize the history of the site. In our workshops, what we heard over and over is that people really cared about the rivers and the wildlife and the sensitive areas, but they also wanted Bozeman to have an activated park where they could come and do many different things. So with that input, we designed an adventure playground, pavilions of all sizes, an outdoor amphitheater, a climbing boulder, and other amenities, but always with that connection to nature that people really emphasized. At the same time, we were raising private funds. The city, through the TOP bond, contributed $4.5 million, and over a number of years, 450 donors contributed over $11 million in private support to match that. These people invited us into their homes to meet with their neighbors. We gave park tours. We got local businesses to act as sponsors. Last year at our community foundation's Give Big Gallatin Valley Day, people gave over $60,000 to this project to help us meet our goal. So today, all of these ideas and partnerships are literally baked into the DNA of this park. The recreation staff from our Parks Department are housed in the new Community Park Center, which was formerly the Boys and Girls Club, and that is the hub for our city's recreation programming, so it's a wonderful partnership with this park. And so this citizen engagement that began 8 years ago started with project advocacy, then went into community-supported design, and today this is an enduring public-private partnership. Many of the partners that helped us first with the vision of the park are today partnering with the City of Bozeman on programming. Gallatin Valley Food Bank will manage the Learning Garden in the park. Sacagawea Audubon continues to do birding walks. Greater Gallatin Watershed Council is doing their stream team's water quality. So all of these partnerships over time are enduring forward in this project. And I guess in closing, what I would share is that when we started this project, I thought of parks as places that provide all sorts of health benefits, where we can get outside and we can recreate. And that is all true, but really what I've come to realize is that fundamentally they are shared gathering spaces for our community. And when we design them together and use them together, I think they represent sort of our greatest shared vision of who we are. So very excited to see this project come forward. And when I look across this room, I see so many people that have been involved, so I just thank all of you.
Thank you, everyone, for having me back. I'm Heather Grenier, President and CEO for HRDC. And I want to start just by one side note of thanking this community and people in this room who are volunteering at our food bank and many of other programs and services, and just highlight how involved and engaged this community is. Just in the last year, our programs and services benefited from over 100,000 volunteer hours. If you break that down into full-time employees, that is an additional 58 full-time employees in our organization. And we couldn't do anything we do without everyone in this room. So I just want to start with that framework of how fortunate we are to live in a community where people are so willing to be involved and be part of the solution. HRDC is an organization I won't dive into because many of you in this room sat through a whole presentation on HRDC. However, one of the key tenets of our organization is community involvement, citizen engagement, etc. And our job is to engage the community in how we approach coming up with solutions and how we decide what we're going to tackle for our community. And that starts from the community needs assessment process. It's done every 3 years, where we do surveys, we do stakeholder groups, we do focus groups, we do town hall discussions, and we talk to our community and say, what are the things that are important to you and the challenges you see on the ground that we need to be creating solutions to or addressing? It's also part of our board structure. We have a tripartite board structure that requires a third of our board to be public representatives, a third to be private, and a third to be our end user and represent our end user. So our decisions are made from multifaceted input from the community. We actually have one of the appointed seats that Jim was speaking to for Gallant County is a seat on our board of directors. We also have one for Park County. Right now, we have city councilmen from West Yellowstone and Three Forks seated on our board as well. We try to make sure we have a good demographic representation as well. But really it ties down to grassroots engagement, and that's involving ourselves and our volunteers and our donors and our board members in every possible way. And how that ties to the Warming Center, which was the pitch at the beginning of what I'm speaking to, is actually through the Community Affordable Housing Advisory Board, one of the many advisory boards Carson was speaking to. And that Community Affordable Housing Advisory Board actually has a designated seat for crossover representation to another local group called the Greater Gallatin Homeless Action Coalition. And the Warming Center started as a conversation through the group, the Greater Gallatin Homeless Action Coalition. Recommendations were then carried forward to the Community Affordable Housing Advisory Board. And a group subcommittee got together and said, we need to respond to this urgent need in our community of no shelter. It was really ticked up following the death in our community and unfortunate loss of a member of our community due to exposure of the elements. And that subcommittee got together, and because of our remarkable people in this community. Within 12 days, we had the warming center opened. And it's still here. We just closed our 8th or 9th season, sorry. And funding, and the way that that came together was a combination of actually a partnership with county and city. Our first year of operations, we operated out of several different buildings at the fairgrounds. And that was only possible due to our partnership with the county. And some of our startup funding came from the city to make that first season happen. We don't do anything, I think, in this community without partnerships, as has been, I think, part of the theme of today's conversation. And through those advisory boards, informing those partnerships and informing those municipalities, those things become possible. Our partnership with the City of Bozeman actually started in the early 90s around the conversation of affordable housing, and that was when emergency responders were required to live within a certain distance of city limits so that they could have adequate and appropriate response times. And the cost of housing and home ownership at that time was creating a challenge for those employees to meet that requirement. And that partnership started with that conversation and that need being identified in the community, and the city and HRDC sitting down and trying to come up with a solution. And that created the first actual housing land trust in the state of Montana, which still is thriving and in our community today, which provides home ownership at affordable prices via leased land. And that is an approach that works to continue that affordability in perpetuity and is a great demonstration of a solid partnership and one that we continue to work towards and adding new land trusts to our community. And so I think there are a lot of ways to get involved. The Community Affordable Housing Advisory Board is the one that I think gets a lot of attention because affordable housing is a significant issue in our community, but that really is important to be involved and participate. There are a lot of upcoming opportunities to be involved and inform the affordable housing discussion in general. The needs assessment was just completed for the City of Bozeman. They'll start working on their affordable housing action plan and just got a new affordable housing manager on staff. So there will be a lot of opportunity as this plan comes together to inform that plan and be involved, participating in putting that plan together. In addition, HRDC, as our grassroots engagement component, we have a lot of advisory boards as well. And so if anyone's interested in participating at a more in-depth level, we have an advisory board for our Gallup Valley Food Bank. We have one for our Warming Center. We have one for just about every focus area that we have. And that similar structure as our actual board of directors exists there, where we try and make sure that we have input and involvement from not only our end users, but a broad spectrum of the community to make sure we're approaching things in the right way and making the right connections and the right partnerships and moving forward in the right direction. So with that, that will lead us to our overarching citizen involvement and engagement piece, and I'll turn it back over to Carson.
We're gonna have a little bit of discussion about citizen advisory boards, and then we'll open it up to questions, comments, and further discussion. And so I'd just like to engage each of you to say something different than what you've already said about a citizen advisory boards. Maybe what are the caveats or what are the worries that we need to have about the usefulness of civic engagement through citizen advisory boards?
I will jump in. I hope I understood your question correctly, but even if I didn't, I'm going to make this pitch anyway. Talked about how over all of our boards, 41, we appoint 233 people, there are 16 vacancies. That is probably undercounting. I think there are a lot of vacancies that are going to open up. We see the same faces over and over and over again on a lot of our boards. Fresh ideas are great. If you really want to get involved, there's a place for you. We need to help, especially in the county. Just an example of some of these: Meadowview Cemetery, Middlewood Cottonwood Zoning Board of Adjustment, Mountain Green Cemetery. Those things don't happen without those citizens pitching in and helping make that happen. So the downside is, I think we're going to start to lose people. I think there's a generation coming up that does not have the civic service sensibility that you all do. And so I think that's what we have to be careful of.
I guess when I think about that question, what I think about is how to use volunteers well. I think there's a reluctance sometimes to get involved because group dynamic can sometimes overwhelm effective use of people's time. So So I think when you put yourself into the position, it's really important that you are clear about what the expectations are for you as a volunteer board member, but also what your expectations are. And I think just making sure that you're, you know, there's always a balance when you're managing a project between being really open to new ideas and getting the work done. And so you have to let go a little bit so that you listen to people, so that you're respectful and open. And you also sometimes have to keep things moving along. So I think really thinking about what volunteer opportunities really suit you, and as you get into them, really asking the questions to understand what the expectations are, but for them to also understand your expectations, is important for it to be sort of an effective use of your time.
I would say just some of the things I've experienced that can be challenges are just simply managing special interests and keeping in front of the group what the end goal is, and who that end goal is benefiting or what the purpose is. So maybe sort of a overarching job description for that advisory board of what they're collectively working toward and what the bigger picture is. Because it can, Maddie, you spoke to this a little bit, that if you get into group dynamics and special interests can get really easily sidetracked and you lose the end vision or the end purpose of the group as a whole.
I think that we have to really work hard to recruit younger people. And when I say younger, I'm talking like 50 and under. But it's really important that we make a big effort to do that and to sort of cultivate that opportunity for them to get involved.
So just one pointed, the Bozeman Area Bicycle Advisory Board, better known as BABAB, does recruit younger people because they actually ride bicycles better than some of us older folk.
Yeah.
And more often. But to me, it's a board that represents that they've hit that right note, meaning they're ahead of the city commission all the time on what the bicycling needs of the city are. They know where the gaps are. The city wouldn't necessarily know where the gaps are. They're pointing that out. They're giving advice on, you're going to do spend X number of dollars on bicycling in the city. This is where you should spend it. And the city commission hears that. But they don't get caught up in the, oh my God, they're not doing everything that we want them to do. And they recognize that the commission has a role in allocating whatever the funds are and the energy in a way that benefits the city as a whole across the board, because that's what the commissioners are about, figuring out how to divide up the apple in a way that benefits the entire community. And that's great. But managing that expectation on advisory boards is sometimes difficult. I've heard people say, you don't listen to us. And the reality is, I think, at least when I was on the commission, we always listened, one. And two, is it always had an impact. Didn't necessarily change what we were thinking or what we otherwise would have done, but it had an impact on how we thought about it. But that's a little bit of the yin and yang of it.
I'd like to address Maddie's concern about young people. And I would like to put something out to the four of you. If you could gather together for an hour or two sometime this spring and summarize what you just said in the last 5 minutes about how it works, the dynamics, your choices, how you have to keep your goals ahead, sometimes you have to be flexible, let go of things, and put together a 2-page outline for the teachers in the schools. And it would be an exercise that they could use with their students to do a simulation of a public service project. Whether it actually was done or not, but kids are very smart. And they understand how you have to give in a little bit, and sometimes you have to lead, and sometimes they understand all this, but it isn't necessarily engaged in a very specific way. Even a half-hour project each semester, done in the beginning, and then maybe a follow-up thing in the spring, that was outlined by people who've been through it, like you guys, to go through what are the questions, what are the choices, what do you gain, what do you lose, how do you work about your own emotions when you're trying. I mean, there are a lot of things, kids are right in the heart of it, they get it.
There's been information in the news recently about the walking, bicycling trails from Stormhill Park to the M. Yeah. Is there somewhere a map that shows where that will go?
Yes.
did look at it last night at the Parks Advisory Board, speaking of advisory boards. The city has a map that changed because of getting rights of way and easement. So a final one is done. It will be up shortly for you. It basically goes south of Bridger Drive all the way along city property, because north of the drive is county and south is city. So there's a trail there and then, and then the
creek
starts to bend to go north is where there'll be a flashing light crossing, and then it'll be north of the road for the rest of the way to the M. Right before the end, there will be an underpass to the parking lot that's there. Two parking lots will, in a sense, be connected, and that would be pedestrian or bike or whatever. So that's the basic outline. It's not on the road the entire way. So a young kid, you can send your 12-year-old to ride it, and you know that they would, it wouldn't be the road. That's a cooperation of the county and the Forest Service, GBLT, and many others to get it together. But of course, it will be available, and it will take all summer to build it. So
it'll be posted on the city website.
Yeah.
And you could go to the city website, look up citizen advisory boards, go to the Recreation and Parks Board, and at least see what the agenda item looked like for their last meeting as well.
Be a consideration for decreasing the speed limit there?
Especially? Yes.
Oh, good.
I'd like to hear more about where you're at with the affordable housing, developments. I know that, I think I read about one that would happen behind Walmart, and whether or not they're all going to be kind of isolated in one area. Or also, I'm curious, it sounded like it's a focus on a big development. So is that the trend that it'll be? It'll be, you know, big housing developments?
Affordable housing and workforce housing. Because the community, the CAHAB, whatever that is, the Housing Advisory Board, deals with the gamut. From people that don't have any homes, to low-cost apartments, to homeownership in some way to get people there, and it runs that gamut. They're totally different pieces of the action that has to happen, and there's different ways to do it, from a tax write-off. That's the way some of those things are funded, with tax credits for people, and that's mostly apartments. Maybe you're asking about home ownership and reduced price houses as well. And Heather, you're going to answer all of it. From the city's perspective, we were always about, we want inclusionary zoning, meaning we want people of all socioeconomic groups to be living together, as opposed to the rich people are over here and the poor people are over there. I live on the south side, and it's amazing to me to look at what that neighborhood must have once been. Lots of little small lots. Little bungalow houses, and then the big ones, all living in the same community together. I don't think anybody wants to change that.
We could spend the whole Friday forum and probably 10 more on affordable housing, so I don't want to get too stuck here. There are currently about 4 housing developments that HRDC is involved in the city of Bozeman, that are all in various phases, and they all actually have different target populations. Some are home ownership, some are affordable rental units, some are larger multifamily developments, some are smaller single family homes. So I would say there's not a specific type of development or location that any of it's targeting. Really, the goal is that you sprinkle it throughout and that it's available at all different levels throughout the entire community.
So I guess I don't understand the concept of, in terms of, you know, we as volunteers can voice our opinions in terms of ideas, but how can we actually be involved in the actual, perhaps the construction of the facilities, you know, synonymous with something like Habitat for Humanity? Is that possible at all, or?
Yes, absolutely. HRDC is not the only ones working on housing development. Habitat has opportunities as well. Anything that we're involved in, we have opportunities throughout the whole process, whether it's planning, design, landscaping, where we try and engage people, anything that we can do to lower the cost,
right,
and that keeps the rent down or the home purchase price down in the long run.
You are tuned to KGVM Bozeman, Gallatin Valley Community Radio.
I think it might be helpful for maybe you, Carson, to say how people should proceed if they might be interested in getting on a citizen advisory board. How would you go about doing it? All the citizen advisory boards are described in the section of the website, so you can see what they are.
I'm a Luddite, and I can handle it, so all of us can handle it. You go to the city's website, With just a few press buttons, you get to citizen advisory boards. And they're all listed alphabetically. And you click on the board, and it tells you what it's about. And then somewhere in there, there's a way to figure out if there are vacancies on that board at the moment. They all have terms, though, so you can look up who's on the board and see when their terms end. And then there's a city application for the board. My advice to anybody that decides their interest in a given board is go to a couple meetings before you apply. Just get a feel for what it's like. I did have a couple people come to various meetings that I was the liaison to, and they sat there for a while, and then they called me up later and said, you know what, maybe I'll look for another board. So that's a good thing. That's absolutely a good thing. Each board has a commissioner liaison. You could call them up, ask them about what the situation is, or maybe you know someone on the board, talk to them about it as well. It is time. Spend 30, if you want to look through 39 or 38 boards, I don't know what the number is for the city, and read about each one of them. But their bylaws and their agendas, they're all there.
You don't need to be on a board to be involved. I mean, show up. They need help too. So we all know there are doers, and then there are just people who come up, and we're always looking for doers.
There's lots of opportunity for volunteers, and you don't have to be on a board. Most of us are tired of that. But to be able to put out from some of these advisory boards some way for people to know, I mean, because all the people that work at the food bank, all the people that do home delivery of foods and all those kinds of things, plus trail work, there's lots of things going on. And any kind of way to get the word out on volunteers for different advisory boards or different NGOs or whatever, I think is really useful. And I don't know how we're going to organize it, but it's what a lot of people like to do, where they can just volunteer for something.
On the volunteer site, I'll just note there's a, I think it's volunteersouthwestmontana.org. It's actually hosted on the Greater Gallatin United Way website, but they list all the volunteer opportunities, well, not all of them, but a significant amount of volunteer opportunities for a lot of nonprofit organizations locally, so it's a good starting point. I can't speak to how we pull in the advisory board pieces, but I think that's totally feasible to cross that over and list some of those opportunities there too. I think it's volunteersouthwestmontana.com, but if you go to Greater Gallatin United Way website, there's a link right on there. I'm not 100% sure of it outside of that, but you can link to it from there. And they've got in there all of HRDC's volunteer opportunities are linked on there, as well as many other local nonprofit organizations.
The question was, how do accessory dwelling units fit into the mix of housing and what's going on now with it? Deputy Mayor Mel came to me, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago and said, what do you think about a trails and parks bond? And do you think it will pass? And he really led the way on that. And the end result has been something that is beyond any of our wildest expectations. We leveraged a lot of that money into more money, TPL and that park being a significant piece of that, all to the benefit of all of us. And so I'm going to compliment Deputy Mayor Mel and make him talk about ADUs and how it fits into climate-related issues, how it fits into density. I'm not sure there's been anything that's done about it in the last few years other than the zoning changes that were made about a year and a half ago.
Well, just talk about ADUs. About a year ago, the city updated it. It started when Carson was still mayor, and then it went into effect at the end of March. So it's just more than a year. We're basically making it much easier to build ADUs. And so there's a two-pager that's available from the planning department. It's online through the website at the planning department, or you can go to the STIF building, which is the building directly south of the federal building, and pick it up. And it will tell you, depending where you live, what you have, but also your rights as neighbors. If you're worried about your neighbor building an ADU, what they can do and not do, and things like that. And it's a good description. And we're generally in favor of them, because it allows for what's called gentle infill. So infill often it's very slight, but it allows for granny flats. So if you have a family member that wants to live there, or if you're just looking for a way, because Bozeman is more expensive to make ends meet, it can provide for either. And so we have made it easier, although not, it still has to have certain size and other restraints to it. But the two-pager will answer probably 99% of the questions, and then right at the bottom is a phone number, like was illustrated before, the staff who can help you out. So I'd either go online and get it, or stop by the STIF building and just ask for a copy of it.
So an accessory dwelling unit is a unit, a living unit that's built on a lot where there's another house. I think that can't be connected or it's not an accessory dwelling unit. And different kinds of zoning have different rules about when you can build them and when you can't and under what conditions. And when the commission looked at the zoning rules the last time around, we decided this is a gentle density approach that would allow us to have more dense neighborhoods without changing the fundamental character of them. It doesn't always not change the fundamental character of a given lot, but by and large, I think that we kind of hit that right. Talk about partnerships, Montana State University, particularly through Ralph Johnson and the Department of Architecture, has gone a long way towards helping the city and others think through how we can get to affordable housing and low-cost housing. Tiny homes is something that he's pioneered and a few other things as well, so it's been great.
If you're a county resident, can you be on a city advisory board? I'm assuming you cannot, but that you could maybe be in room and give suggestions.
Corollary
to that is because the urban, rural, urban wild interface boundary around the city involves county land, wildlife, wildlife habitat for the animals who need to come down and use it in the spring and leave them. And the city expansion for whatever reasons, what is the citizen involvement possibilities for that, since it's a county, city, hopefully mutually beneficial issue?
Some city citizen advisory boards allow county residents on them, and some have slots for county residents. Some of those slots are appointed by the county commission as well. So you have to look at the citizen advisory board you're interested in, and it will tell you what that is. Wildlife and sort of city-county connections with one another.
Currently now we're in negotiation about how much of that interface there is between the city and the county and what is currently county and our expectations about how quickly some of those spaces we should be prepared for them to be annexed as city and which places probably aren't identified as that.
Is there opportunity for citizen involvement in those discussions?
Yeah, right now the PCC or the Planning Coordination Committee is generally in the big community room up in the county courthouse, big room, and they've been hoping to get as much public involvement as they could.
And we will be looking at two ideas. One is the larger triangle, Belgrade, Four Corners, Bozeman, and everything in between. And then there's also a proposal where Don from the county and myself and then staff from both sides met last week to start to work out the beginnings of a memorandum of understanding that would incorporate a lot of what Scott talked about that, say 1,500 feet or more around the city if there was a proposal for development that it would meet city close to city standards as it goes forward. And I'm greatly simplifying. But the city commission probably will have a meeting on that in July for a lot of public input. And everyone from the whole county would be welcome so that people would have a chance to both learn more about it and provide input. And there's no way there'll be decision making until the fall. So it's on a schedule, but it's not in a rapid schedule. So there'll be a lot of opportunity for input.
So this is following up on getting new faces on advisory boards in the city and the county. And it's my experience and also watching Carson with his first political bid being on the cemetery board and what that led to. Not that that's necessarily a goal, but with young people, with newer people in town, it's a really great way to get to know the community and find something you're interested in without having to have expertise, really. You have to have interest, that's it. And I think new faces are really important. We're all seeing that, as Maddie said. And diversity is important. And I've done a little bit of trying to encourage Native Americans to get on citizen advisory boards with their interests. I think we all need to encourage that. And other people who are new and may not know, what their place is in town yet. And just help them find what might be right for them. And it's really kind of a non-threatening way to get to be part of the government. And maybe they'll be commissioners someday.
The key here is how you balance community involvement, community input with decision making. And I think we're talking about a system that isn't perfect, but it's working pretty well. And so I appreciate that. So, Robert Hawks.
The county doesn't charge any impact fees.
you have infrastructure needs that come with development, you pay for those. So you must have some form or some formula that, while not called per se impact fees, it must serve the same purpose. Would that be correct?
Yes, we try to get it around. I don't know that it serves the same purpose. What we try to do is make the developer pay for the impact that they have, but where the city can explain to you how their impact fees work a lot better than I can. As I understand the city's impact fees, they do a much better job of being able to finance incremental development.
I'm speaking of in the county.
Yeah, I understand. I'm just trying to draw the distinction between how we do it. There was a subdivision proposed up in Big Sky, kind of by the Ace Hardware as you turn onto, you know, Lone Peak Trail, that the county commission denied because of a traffic impact study. They weren't willing to put in turn lane. Ultimately, settled. We got a Tiger grant up there. We tried to make the developer pay for their particular piece of impact. So we said in a traffic impact study said, you're going to generate X number of trips per day, you're going to need a turn lane for safety purposes so that there aren't accidents on Lone Peak Trail. We try to do that. However, I think if I understand how impact fees work in the city, particularly in that situation, the city may have been able to say at some point, the cumulative impact of this development is going to require an upgrade at the traffic light at the intersection. And could Chris, do I have that right? Could generally kind of take money to help them, to help pay for that?
Slightly different, but good enough.
Okay, thank you.
So you have some form of impact fee.
We have some way, we have some mechanism of making developers pay their way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Second clarification I was after was that in your budgeting information, you suggested that the funds flow in from separate sources. When you get your property taxes back and put them in your budget, what do you do with other state funds that flow into the county? Do you have a separate category for that, or does everything go into the general fund?
No, we have governmental fund accounting, and it depends particularly on where that's coming. Carson talked about gas taxes. You know, we get a share of that money. Right now, in front of the legislature, there was a bill to take some of what's called entitlement funds. So when you register your car, some of that money gets sent up to the state, and then the state divvies it out among all the counties. The legislature wants to raid part of that to help fund the Office of Public Defender. That kind of goes into separate funds.
So you account for that funding in your presentation. You keep a record of the
yes.
account.
Yep, as non-tax revenue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very
much. Thank you to this wonderful group of panelists. We're very proud of Bozeman. It is a community. It isn't just a place to live. So.
You have been listening to an MSU Wanderlust Friday forum entitled The Role of Active Citizenship in Thriving Communities, focusing on citizen engagement in city and county government. The panel included former Bozeman Mayor Carson Taylor, Gallatin County Administrator Jim Doerr, Trust for Public Lands Project Manager Maddie Pope, and HRDC Executive Director Heather Grenier. It was recorded at the Bozeman Public Library on April 12, 2019. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LaClaire for Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of this station's staff, underwriters, or board of directors. We thank you for listening and for your support of Community Radio, Gallatin Valley Community Radio.